All right. As I promised last week, this is going to be a little different. We're going to do something a little different this week. We're going to get into the wacky world of rhetoric. And I use the word wacky deliberately. If you've not been exposed to classic rhetoric, it's a different world, and sometimes you kind of wonder what they're thinking when they use some of these things. But it's also very interesting, and it's important actually. And as I mentioned before, this is becoming quite a bit more important in New Testament scholarship, particularly over the last 3 decades, maybe 2 decades, particularly the last 2 decades. So I mentioned last week we're going to explore in these 6 weeks 2 fairly new trends in New Testament scholarship. In addition to that, we're going to do some reading of Paul too, reading of Paul's letters. We'll begin that next week. But both of these new trends are directed to trying to understand what Paul was trying to say. As I mentioned before, almost anyone who studied Paul very long really struggles with some of the things he was saying. And both of these trends can be described as somewhat controversial, but because they may challenge some aspects of long-standing Christian thinking. And I'll explain that as we go through here. But to the proponents of these trends, they seem to answer a number of questions about Paul that were troublesome before, and that's why I've been kind of interested in them. They do explain some things to me about Paul that I hadn't realized before. The two trends, I described them briefly last week. The first one is trying to read Paul's writing as rhetorical arguments and not just the writings of a pastor trying to calm down his churches. And also not as, in the way he talks, not trying to read his personality into it, because he has a rhetorical personality in these, as you'll see. The second trend is, which we'll talk about much later, is a new way of interpreting Paul that has been labeled New Perspectives on Paul, and that's coming along at about the same time. And it's a different group of people, different group of scholars who are doing it, but they give you some kind of interesting aspects on how to interpret Paul. Today we're going to focus just on the first trend, rhetorical Paul, and we're going to spend the whole lesson on rhetoric and set the stage for possibly understanding Paul in a different way. So we're going to plunge into the world of ancient Greek letters, rhetoric, and as we get into this review, we're going to be jumping back and forth into actually the book of Romans primarily as the example of how he used rhetoric. And I think that, you'll find that quite interesting in how he used rhetoric in that. So first, let's kind of establish things, a very brief history of rhetoric. Humans have studied rhetoric and actually praised rhetoric since the very early days of the written word. Some of the very first civilizations, the Mesopotamians and the ancient Egyptians, both valued the ability to speak with eloquence and wisdom. But it wasn't until the rise of Greek democracy that rhetoric became a very high art that was studied and developed in a very systematic way. Most historians credit the ancient city-state of Athens to be the birthplace of classical rhetoric. Because Athenian democracy, which was very unusual, marshaled every free male to be in politics. It was a requirement of being in the city, a citizenship requirement. Now, so every Athenian male had to be ready to stand in the assembly. Now, let me modify that. Every free Athenian male, because a lot of the males were slaves. They didn't get to take rhetoric, but the free men did, and women did not. But they had to learn how to use rhetoric, because a man's success and influence in ancient Athens depended on his rhetorical ability, and it was understood that you could be asked at any time to stand before the assembly and try to persuade people to vote for a particular piece of legislation. So it became a big deal in that city, in the surrounding area. And consequently, some small schools dedicated to teaching rhetoric started to pop up. And the first of these schools began in about the 5th century, and it was a group of itinerant teachers called the Sophists. That's where we get our words, sophistry. Now, the Sophists actually were not highly respected because it felt like they were playing little games with things. That's where we get the word sophistry.
Also, where we get sophomore.
Yes, yes. The Sophists would travel from city to city, teaching people in public spaces how to speak and how to debate. A typical Sophist curriculum consisted of analyzing poetry, defining parts of speech, and instructions, a lot of instructions on argumentation styles, how to convince people of things. They taught their students how to make a weak argument stronger. Now, I mentioned that they were not always that popular, but they prided themselves on the ability to win any debate on a subject, even if they had no prior knowledge of it, through the use of confusing analogies, flowery metaphors, and clever wordplay. In short, they focused on style and presentation, often at the expense of truth. They figured they could win any argument. It doesn't matter whether they were telling the truth or not. At least that's what their critics said. Now, their two biggest critics were Plato and Aristotle. They condemned the Sophists for relying solely on emotion to persuade an audience and for their disregard for truth. But despite all this criticism, the Sophists actually were very important. They had a huge influence on developing this, how to study and teach rhetoric as time went by. But eventually, their approach was replaced by Aristotle. He wrote a classic called The Art of Rhetoric. And a lot of rhetoric after that was based on Aristotle. And it was he taught everyone how to do it in his view the right way. And while he criticized the Sophists and their misuse of rhetoric, he saw what they were doing as a very useful tool in helping audiences see and understand truth. And so he established a new system of understanding and how to teach rhetoric in a pretty classic book. In that book, he defined rhetoric as the faculty of observing, in any given case, the available means of persuasion. He was real big on sizing up your audience ahead of time and saying what means of persuasion will work on this audience. And he talked quite a bit on that. Now, he favored persuasion through reason alone. This is Aristotle. He also wrote a book on logic. And so he preferred to use logic as by far the strongest argument in his view. And he recognized, though, at times an audience would not be sophisticated enough to follow arguments based on scientific or logical principles. And so in those instances, he recognized that persuasive language and techniques were necessary for the truth to be taught. And moreover, rhetoric armed a man with the necessary weapons to refute demagogues and those who use rhetoric for evil purposes. So he thought you had to fight fire with fire sometimes. You had to learn how to use emotional arguments too. Now, Aristotle was kind of alone in this thing that he thought logic was the only way to do it, as we'll see. So in his book, after he established the need up front of the book for rhetorical knowledge, he set out a complete system for teaching and applying rhetoric. And we're not going to get into that. You ought to be happy about that. It's a big book. But I want to mention a couple of things. He emphasized very strongly that, in his view, there were only three means of persuasion: logos, pathos, and ethos. And in the next slide, I'll define what those are. He also said there are three genres of rhetoric: deliberative, forensic, and epideptic. And this is for different. Some of deliberative was for use in business and decision making, and I forget what epideptic was. Forensic actually was sometimes called judicial. It was for lawyers. It was how to argue cases, how to argue what's right and wrong in court. He taught a whole lot about rhetorical devices, and I'll mention a few of those later. He talked about parts of speech, and particularly he talked a lot about the effective use of style. So he sort of wrote the book, and this is what everyone was trained in after that. Let's talk about these three modes of persuasion, because it comes up a lot in discussions of rhetoric. The logos argument, the logos mode of persuasion, it's an argument based primarily on logic. This is the one Aristotle loved. Logos is the logic behind an argument, and tries to persuade an audience using very logical arguments and supportive evidence. And, of course, the problem with that is you often don't have a lot of supportive evidence. An ethos one is based more on the fundamental values of your audience. And an ethos argument based on what you understand your audience, basically, fundamental values are, what they value and everything. you base your argument on that in order to sort of soften them up. And in rhetoric, the speaker often uses ethos from the very start of the presentation. So you combine ethos with something else. And in that ethos early part, they try to convince the audience that the presenter is a good person that can be trusted. But basically repeating back to them everything they believe, even if the speaker doesn't believe them. And so the speaker can actually kind of fake it. He believes these things and set them all up. Talk for a while, get them all set up. Pretty soon they think, well, this is a guy that we can trust. And that's right before you then hit him with the arguments. The last one is pathos, and this represents an appeal for the emotions of the audience and elicits feelings that already reside in them. And pathos is actually the communication tactic most used in rhetoric. It's the one that works the best. And you can tell that just by watching commercials on TV. You'll seldom see a commercial on TV that's appealing to your logic. It's appealing to your emotions more than anything else. But anyway, these three can be combined in various ways, and rhetoric, and Aristotle taught how to combine those and how to use them effectively. There were also things called rhetorical devices, and I found one list of 50 rhetorical devices. We're not going to go through. I want to just show you a few, though, that you might even recognize. One of the most common ones is the rhetorical question. A rhetorical question is a question you ask and you don't answer. You just keep right on going. And if you do that quickly and do it well, it leaves a notion in people who are listening that, well, the answer is obvious. So they agree with you right away. I think politicians are really good at this. Example, you know, you say, Mr. Brown, why would you vote for someone who has never kept his promises? And then you just go on. And so they don't have a chance. And you see the value of this in an oral thing. If this was written down as a letter, people had the time to read it, they would read that sentence and say, why would you? And they would think about, well, has he kept his promises or not? And they would think about it and start challenging. You can't do that when you're listening to a talk because he's on to four or five sentences down the road already. If you want to keep up, you got to listen. So these things tend to sink in very quickly and move on. And you'll see there's actually a lot of rhetorical questions in the New Testament in all these letters. You can use allusions to just make a point very quickly. Always plan ahead. It wasn't raining when Noah built the ark. And then you just go on. And people see that and say, okay, I understand that. Repetition is a good thing in rhetoric. Most people who have read Lincoln's Gettysburg Address can't remember a lot of it, but they tend to remember this. A government of the people, by the people, for the people shall not perish from this earth. And people that registers people may say, oh, the government is for the people. That's good. And so repetition is a common thing. Nostalgia promotes a desire to go back in time when things were better. Nostalgia really works. Make America great again. It worked. Hyperbole. This is where you use exaggeration to make a point. Now, the reason I want to show these things is just to show that there are a lot of devices, and all of these devices, quite a few of these devices, in various ways show up in a lot of New Testament letters. It wasn't recognized before, but they're spotting them more and more all the time. Now, the thing is, we want to talk about is what rhetorical approach did Paul use? Paul used a number of approaches, but he used a writing style that was, in fact, quite common for other letter writers in his day. And modern scholars call this an epistolary diatribe. Now, the epistolary, you might recognize epistolary. All of Paul's letters were called epistles. Epistolary means a letter. It's a letter diatribe. Now, we need to get into what is a diatribe, then. So an epistolary diatribe is basically a presentation made to correct the incorrect ideas of someone else. And it could be in a short form with just a few sentences or a much larger format that was called a scholastic diatribe. And Paul used both of these. It's a very, very sophisticated way of making an argument and actually not easy to understand when we really get into it, particularly the scholastic diatribes. But I want to say a word about diatribes first. Make sure you understand what they are. In English today, if you look up diatribe, you'll find it refers to a venomous, harsh, verbal tongue lashing. You don't want to be the victim of a diatribe. People come at you with diatribes. The original Greek had an entirely different meaning. The diatribe was a rhetorical format. It was used in an academic setting in philosophical schools. This is the way they taught students. And it was the purpose of a diatribe was to convince a class or whoever the audience was to change their way of thinking on a particular subject. This is when the speaker knew they were thinking about something and probably wrong and he wanted to correct it. And the diatribe was designed to do that. And so the purpose was not to inform them about something new, but to transform the class into a different way of thinking. So it was used primarily for either ethical or religious instructions. And this may be where Paul learned it. We don't know. We know that Paul was highly educated as both a Jew and a Roman citizen. So he may have picked this up in religious schools. We don't know. But this is the way it was often used. Now, how do we recognize a diatribe? People who now know how to recognize a diatribe can often spot it just by reading letters in the New Testament. I couldn't. First, because it has certain characteristic elements that keep appearing repeatedly. One is the frequent use of rhetorical questions. When you see that coming over and over again, you begin to realize there's something going on here. The second one is really interesting. It's the repeated use of what are called imaginary interlocutors or imaginary characters. These are imaginary protagonists that Paul is arguing with when he's in the argumentative phase of the diatribe. This is a fancy way of saying that Paul is not always the speaker. This is really, really important to understand. This is where people begin to realize maybe we're not listening to Paul correctly because we're not always listening to Paul. Sometimes Paul is pretending to be someone else. That's the way the diatribe works. The speaker, and this is considered to be the very persuasive part of the diatribe, the speaker, in this case, if it's Paul or one of his lieutenants giving the speech, is not attacking the audience or the class. In this case, one of his churches that might be listening to this. In this case, in the case of Romans, it's the Roman Christians he's addressing. He's not attacking them. He's arguing with someone on the stage with him who's not there. It's an imaginary person standing next to him. And that imaginary person is interrupting Paul and asking questions and disagreeing with him. And this is going on back and forth. And when we read it, we don't see it because it's hard to see. But when it's acted out on a stage or in front of an audience, it turns out that it's pretty fairly easy to show this because the speaker knows, the speaker's already trained in what to emphasize here and when there's an imaginary person. And so he may act it out, it's believed that he probably acts out on the stage. He would turn and ask a question by pointing at someone or something or just nothing right next to him and say, say something to him. And then he would walk over here and answer. And so everyone knew what was going on. And everyone knew when Paul was speaking and when someone else was speaking. It's very hard to see that when you're reading in the text today. He's arguing with someone else, and the Roman Christians are simply listening to the argument. They don't feel like they're being attacked, because Paul uses some pretty rough language in some of these arguments, but they don't feel like he's addressing it to them. He's addressing it to this imaginary person standing next to him who's disagreeing with him constantly. And therefore, the audience doesn't feel threatened, and they're more likely to listen to the depth of the argument. So that's one thing that you can see in a diatribe. There's a frequent use of what they call the apostrophe, which just means a direct verbal assault on the identified imaginary character. And Paul does a little name calling. And we're always a little shocked at his rough use of language sometimes, but he's arguing with this person up on the stage. This is one I spotted. You, old man, you dare judge others? And you can see the person who's presenting all this is probably shouting at that time, showing his anger. But there's frequent uses of this kind of sudden changes where the speaker speaks up and is yelling at someone. Now, there's some other repeated elements, too. And this is one of the most interesting ones. It's called a speech in character. And I'm going to give you a good example of that out of Romans. This is an extended speech to elaborate on a particular point. And during this entire speech, Paul is playing the imaginary character. He's giving the speech, but when we read it, we don't realize it. It's not Paul talking. And this is one of the things that we really learned by studying rhetoric and how it was used in those days. So when you see a speech in character, sometimes it can be a half a chapter out of one of Paul's letters. It will be someone else talking, and we don't realize it. And I can show you how that has confused people. There are frequent refutations of arguments. This imaginary character on the stage with you raises some objection to something that Paul has just argued, and Paul immediately refutes it, usually with very strong language. And so it's just with a short phrase or something, he will cut him off and say, no, that's wrong, and correct him immediately. There are always appeals to authority, particularly after Paul has made, or anyone has made, what he thinks is a strong argument that's convinced people. He will then back it up by quoting an authority. And with Paul, the authority is always Jewish scripture. Constantly he's repeating scripture out of the Old Testament. And so here's the problem then for us. We can't see this in our Bibles. It's very hard to see. How to recognize who is saying what. In modern English writing, it could be very straightforward. The writer simply states who's speaking by saying something like, and then Paul said, and then followed by quote marks, and you can see this is what Paul said. It's not done that way. And in fact, in Paul's letters, this is one of Paul's letters, and this is actually a copy of a copy of a copy of a copy of one of Paul's letters. But this is Koine Greek. Koine Greek has some very interesting characteristics. This is the Greek, I should mention that Alexander the Great put all across his empire, and this is what the New Testament was written in predominantly. Everything in the New Testament was written in this. There are no punctuation marks, no periods, no commas.
How is it possible that original document survived?
This is not an original. It's a copy of a copy of a copy of a copy of a copy. None of the originals are around anymore. They've dissolved.
Yeah, sure. So they survived long enough for somebody to copy them.
Right, and eventually someone put it in plastic and it's in a museum somewhere. But this could have been written centuries after Paul and just copied. We don't know for sure.
Obviously somebody realized it was a document worth saving.
Yeah, and most scholars believe that, you know, of all the things that were written in the New Testament times, letters and everything, we probably have less than 5% of it. I mean, so much has been lost.
You got to realize, copying that doesn't mean putting it on a copier.
No.
Whoever copied it could change it.
So, having a good scribe, and amnesis as we defined it last week, Paul had to have good scribes to do what he was doing. In fact, it was believed when he sent out a letter, like the letter to the Corinthians, this is not one church. This is all the churches in Corinth. And with many, so he probably sent someone out then when the letter was ready to go who probably had 7 or 8 or 9 copies of the letter because he was going to be leaving one at each church. And so he probably went out with 8 or 9 of them. And it's generally believed there was one extra copy that was the markup copy where Paul gave him all the instructions of what to emphasize when he's doing the performance. So,
and you remember how they gave things emphasis? They exaggerated?
Mm-hmm.
Well, maybe they didn't copy exactly what it said. So the comment is, it doesn't necessarily mean that is exactly what it said because of all these other things that were going on.
Mm-hmm.
What we're talking about today.
Well, but it's really important that there's no quote marks. I'm going to emphasize that. How do you know who's talking and when they're talking without quote marks? Well, it turns out that they understood that very well, that that was an issue. And so they had what they call rhetorical markers they put into the text so that they would know when someone was talking. And so I want to remind you, this was not a problem for the audience. It's a problem for us today reading.
When someone is performing, they establish the character by whether they're looking up because the person is shorter or taller than they are, or looking one direction or the other, or their inflection, their intonation in their voice. And that doesn't come through when it's written.
No, that's the point.
It's an interpreter.
Yeah, and a great deal of communication is not just text. It's body language, it's tone of voice, it's a lot of things. So this was not a problem for the audience because we recognize that there are trained readers who often perform dialogue portions of letters, and many of them the audience couldn't read anyway. So with no punctuation marks, Paul would use well-known rhetorical markers to indicate who was talking. The most common one is the quotes from the interlocutor, the character, were usually preceded by the word say or some version of say or said. So it would be if you see a phrase in one of Paul's sentences that says, you have heard it said, or someone will say, that's the clue. The very next words of the imaginary person talking from then on. That's where the quote starts. And so you'll see that. We'll see that in some things we'll look at here today. Then you have to know when does the quote stop. And the way it stops is there's a reputation from Paul, and it's always led off by what they call an adversative conjunction, something like the word but or therefore, something like that, immediately followed by a little name-calling. Wait, or but, you fool. And then you knew Paul was talking from that point on, so that the other quote was put in right there. So that's the way they did it in those days, because there was no punctuation. There's a lot of other issues with not having punctuation. If you've ever played around with it, you can take a sentence with a lot of commas in it and move the commas around, and the sentence is totally different. And so it can be very confusing. And this was a problem for early translators of the Bible. Where do you put the commas? How do you separate those words? Sometimes they're all jammed together. Anyway, so Paul built this into the text to let people know when he was talking and when someone else was talking. So the fundamental question here is, how does the diatribe actually work? And we're assuming it worked. Otherwise, people wouldn't have been using it so much. But for the rest of the lesson today, we're going to plunge into the book of Romans and try to understand it as a scholastic diatribe, because that's what a lot of scholars are convinced it is. And this scholastic diatribe is one of the most elaborate rhetorical tools you can use. It's designed to make a major argument, and I'll show you how that works in a minute. Oral diatribes try to work by convincing the audience that a plausible falsehood that they believe is actually genuinely false, and then something else is true in its place. And this is not easy to do, but to do this, the diatribe style starts using falsehoods in combination with truth the audience already knows, and then walks them through from one to the next. In the process, new truths are created and new arguments are built on those. It makes use of rhetorical questions, contradictions, staged dialogue involving shifts of speakers and characters. All these are the standard tools used in the process. And when they're acted out on the stage, the audience knows what's going on. When we see these tools being used, we know there's a diatribe going on here somewhere. You know, what is so disorienting to us as moderns? We grew up on straightforward textual arguments because we grew up in an age when everyone can read. And so we don't tend to go hear speeches to learn it. We sit down and read. And we grew up on these very straightforward textual arguments. And we don't quite understand it. And it's shocking to us that in an oral diatribe, the arguments do not have to be perfectly logical, and they don't even have to be true, the beginning arguments. The person making these arguments can say whatever he wants to get to the end point of what he thinks the real truth is. And when people were first exposed to this idea, particularly Christians, they said, wait a minute, are you trying to tell us that Paul is lying to us sometimes? And the answer is no, he's not lying. He's using the diatribe. He's using the tools of the diatribe. But it can be very confusing, because some of the things he says, as I'll show you, were not really something he believed. Or we think they were. Now, we're going to look at the book of Romans as a classic diatribe. And what I'm about to show you is how one scholar has structured the whole thing to show this is the way he thinks Paul designed it. And it's not easy to do what he did. And different scholars might come up with something slightly different. But here is Romans as a diatribe. And I want to point out several things here. It starts out Romans 1:1. And the first 15 verses is the standard things you see in the letter. Hello, I'm Paul. Greetings from all our friends. All these standard things that you put in a letter. The proposition, what they call the proposition, starts in verse 16 of chapter 1. And we're going to read that on the next slide. The proposition is where Paul is laying down the knowledge. He said, this is what I'm going to convince you of. It's just two verses, and we'll talk about that in a minute. And then this is followed by the way he structured it. Sub-propositions 1, 2, 3, and 4. And each of these are sub-arguments to get finally to the final endpoint. And the first one is about, he first wants to convince the audience, and let's talk about the audience here. The audience in Rome, like a lot of his churches, was a mixture of Jewish Christians and Gentile Christians. And most of these churches, we're going to be talking about a lot more about this next week when we get into Corinthians. Most of these churches, there was a lot of tension between these Gentile members and Jewish members. And he wanted to set the ground straight right from the beginning that both of them are sinful. It doesn't matter if you're Jewish or you grew up in sin, and both are sinful. And so that's what this first one is about. And this one and all the others are composed of what's called an expository and an argumentative phase. The expository is the setup. This is where you set up the audience and you tell them, you basically show them that you're agreeing with what they think, and even if you don't agree. And so we don't know exactly how much Paul agrees with it or not, but he says things that will make them happy, and they all agree. And then he moves into the argumentative phase and then starts going after him or going after a character on the stage. So in each one of these, you'll see an expository and an argumentative. And I'm going to take you through that first one up there, not completely through it because it's quite long, you can see. And the way this is divided up is expository is verses 18 through 32, and then the argumentative is 2 all the way through 320. You can see each of these is broken out all the way through the book of Romans. Finally, there's a thing called the exhortatory, which is just giving them a lot of encouragement. It's all the good stuff. How to lead a good Christian life, and then there's a conclusion at the end. So the way they believe he set this up is some introductory stuff up front on Paul, and then everything after that is structured as a diatribe, and then gets back and nice stuff again toward the end. So what I want to do is, let's look at this first sub-proposition just to give you a feel for how this might work. Yeah?
As a random question, in all the digging around you did you actually find any oral presentations that applied this and presented as if it...
You mean people today?
Yeah, like somebody reconstructing. I mean, since this is really meant to be read, this is meant to be oral, it seems the ultimate payout here would be to see it and hear it.
Yeah.
As an oral presentation.
Right. No, I don't know that of anyone who's done that. That's a good point.
Can you go back to the slide 4?
Yeah.
So is this linear? I'm looking at sub-proposition 4, which is chapter 8.
correspond to Joshua chapter 11, verse 36. And then you go to the...
This is the entire proposition. It's broken up into 1 through 30, and later 31 through 11, 36.
Okay.
That your question?
Yeah, that's our stuff.
So these expositories may be sometimes too short, but this is 30 verses. And this is where, again, we don't know what Paulus believes about what he's saying in these expositories, because he's trying to get on their good side in the expositories. He's trying to say things that he thinks they will agree with before he then tries to correct their thinking.
How big were his audiences in
Most of these churches were small. The Roman church, I'm not sure if it was. I need to say something about the Roman church. It was a special thing for Paul. First of all, it wasn't his church. He didn't set it up. And he was dealing with something, a place he'd never been, but he was writing a letter because he was basically trying to set up a visit to Rome to meet them. And he wanted to raise money. That's why he wanted to go there. But something unusual happened. The Roman church was not set up by Paul. He was set up by some unknown missionary, apparently very successfully. It was a fairly substantial church, but I don't know. No one knows the exact number. It was predominantly at first Jewish Christians, because there was a large group of Jews in Rome. And some missionary representing the Jesus movement got up there and converted a lot of the Jewish Christians to Jewish Christianity. So that's what it started out as, with a few Gentiles, not many. And then Emperor Claudius, this was about the year 56 or something like that, drove all the Jews out of Rome, and they had to leave. And
what year did you say?
I think it was around 56 or something like that. Is that right? Maybe it'd been before that. Anyway, but it was well before Paul wrote this letter. But it was temporary. Claudius died, and the next one came in, and when that happened, these Jews moved back into Rome, back into their synagogue. In the meantime, though, a lot of Gentiles had joined this church. And so now these Gentiles thought they were in control, and the Jews showed back up, and they said, no, this is our church. And so they, again, these were Jewish Christians and Gentile Christians. So there was a little bit of tension there, and he was trying to deal with all this in his arguments. So the first thing, again, I said he wanted to show was, let me first show you the main proposition. If we look at this thing again, verses up there at the top, verses 16 and 17, this is what he wanted to prove. And it is a really tough two sentences to read. A diatribe always begins with a simple statement of the proposition. This classic diatribe does. What the argument's going to be about. In this case, it's 116, verse 1, verses 16 and 17 of chapter 1. And this is what it says. For I am not ashamed of the gospel. It is the power of God for salvation to everyone who has faith, to the Jew first and also to the Greek. For in it the righteousness of God is revealed through faith for faith. As it is written, he who through faith is righteous shall live. Now, one of my favorite New Testament scholars, Luke Timothy Johnson, calls this one of the most dense sentences in the Bible. He said, so many people have tried to figure out what he was trying to say here. Then he tries to explain it in the diatribe. But this is really tough. And just as a sideline, remember when I taught on the Reformation, one of the things that I learned there when I was studying Martin Luther had this big book that he wrote. It's called Table Talk, and it's basically his diary. He kept a diary for a long time, and he had a weekly Bible study with a lot of his friends, and they read stuff in the Bible and tried to interpret it and talked about it, and he kept notes and all that, and he put it in his diary. So it's a big book, and it's got a lot of interesting insights into Martin Luther. A lot of scholars who study Luther study that thing called Table Talk. In Table Talk, he talked about these two verses. Martin Luther did not know what rhetoric was. He wasn't trained in it at all. But he talked about these verses. This verse bothered him so much because he couldn't figure out what it meant. And Martin Luther was very worried about his own salvation. He described in Table Talk that he often laid in bed at night sweating, thinking about if I've been good enough or not. And he kept reading this. He said, maybe this is the secret to it. And he prayed about it. He finally concluded, now I know. He figured this out. And this is where he got solo fides. Faith alone is all you need. Because he read it. This is what it is. Who through faith is righteousness shall live. So faith alone, and that's what he taught after that. And so did Calvin. Calvin picked up on that later too. But he got it right from this verse, these two verses. Anyway, this is the main argument. And so, again, the main proposition is followed by these four sub-propositions. Each of them is divided up into expository and argumentative. In each case, in the expository part, Paul is talking directly to the Roman Christians and presenting things about the sub-proposition that he's pretty sure they all agree on. He's getting them on his side. And once he's softened them up a little, he moves on to the argumentative thing. And you can tell when it switches because his language switches accordingly. So let's look at the sub-proposition. The guilt of mankind, or the fact that both Jews and Greeks, Gentiles are all sinners. And the expository goes from verses 18 through 32. It starts out, for the wrath of God is revealed from heaven against all ungodliness and wickedness of men, who by their wickedness suppress the truth. For what can be known about God is plain to them, because God has shown it to them. Ever since the creation of the world, his invisible nature, namely his eternal power and deity, has been clearly perceived from the things that have been made. So they are without excuse, for although they knew God, they did not honor him or give thanks to him, and became futile in their thinking, and their senseless minds were darkened. Claiming to be wise, they became fools and exchanged the glory of the immortal God for images resembling mortal men, or birds, or animals, or reptiles. In other words, they were idolaters. And what he's talking about is pagans who have not yet become Christians. And he knew his audience would agree with him, particularly the Jewish part of the audience. They thought pagans were, because they were terrible idolaters. And he also knew that those who had converted from Gentiles toward Christianity would probably agree with this too. So he starts out here, and then he pours it on really thick. Therefore, God gave them up in the lust of their hearts to impurity, to the dishonoring of their bodies, because they exchanged the truth about God for a lie and worshiped and served the creature rather than the Creator, who is blessed forever. Amen. For this reason, God gave them up to dishonorable passions. Their women exchanged natural relations for unnatural. The men likewise gave up natural relations with women and were consumed with passion for one another. Men committing shameless acts with men and receiving in their own persons the due penalty for their error. Now, this is the famous verse where a lot of outside critics of Paul thinks he's a homophobe. It's important to understand here, we don't know that he actually thought this, but he thought that his audience did think this. They were all very religious people, and they probably thought, yeah, these pagans were really horrible people. Yeah. And the final part of it, and since they did not see fit to acknowledge God, God gave them to a base mind and to improper conduct. They were filled with all manner of wickedness, evil, covetous, malice, full of envy, murder, strife, deceit, malignity. They're gossips, slanderers, haters of God, doubting, boastful. It goes on and on. Foolish, faithless, heartless, ruthless. Though they knew God's decree to do such things as deserve to die, they not only do them, but approve of those who practice them. So this was his expository, and apparently this is something he thought that the Roman Christians would agree with. And so he's basically, I think, telling them, you know these people are really bad, and you want to judge them every way you can. And this is where he then switches. Now he takes over the argumentative. And this is the argumentative phase. It starts in Romans 2, and it goes for a long time, all the way to verse 32, and we're not going to read all of it. He says, therefore, this is that word, one of those key words, means now Paul is talking. Therefore, you have no excuse, O man, lowly man. Sometimes he would say, you fool. Whoever you are, when you judge another, he's telling right away, you cannot judge other people. Only God can do that. He emphasizes that several times in the book of Romans. For in passing judgment, you condemn yourself, because you, the judge, are doing the same things. We know that the judgment of God falls on those who do such things. Do you suppose, O man, that when you judge those who do such things and yet do them themselves, that you will escape the judgment of God? Now, it goes on for 32 verses. But the stance of the entire set of argumentation is to reinforce what Paul was trying to say, that all have sinned and fallen short of the glory of God. It doesn't matter whether you're Jewish or not. He's careful to point out that even though both Gentiles and Jews have sinned, they've done so for completely different reasons. In his view, for the Gentiles, their sin was that they ignored the Creator God and thus fell into depravity. For the Jews, they did not ignore God, but they simply didn't obey God's laws. But they're both sinners. And so he finishes that whole argument that everyone is a sinner. Now, so that's to give you one of these. But what I want to do in the remaining time is to quickly switch over to subproposition 3, because it gives a great example of something I talked about earlier, and that's the speech and character, which is something that may surprise you a little bit how he used that. But the subject here was the relationship between law and the power of sin. And this, we're just going to look at the argumentation phase right down here. And we're going to, but what's interesting here, this chapter 7 is one of the chapters that a lot of critics have really attacked Paul, saying that if you read that, what he says there, it's clear that he's mentally unstable. Why would Christians follow this person at all? He's a nut job. I mean, literally, the books actually say stuff like that. So we're going to see how that works out in this argument. So we're going to jump to the power of sin. And in the argumentative section of this, we see what has been described by scholars as a very classic speech and character. It extends from verse 7 all the way to verse 25. And here's the first 7 through 13. What shall we say then? That the law is sin? Here's the word, say. This is the key thing here. When it says say, it means that someone else is saying this. So he's introducing the interlocutor at this point. That the law is sin? By no means. And so everything from here on is not Paul talking. Yet, if it had not been for law, I should not have known sin. I should not have known what it is to covet if the law had not said, you shall not covet. But sin, finding opportunity in the commandment, wrought in me all kinds of covetousness. Apart from the law, sin lies dead. I was once alive apart from the law, but when the commandment came, sin revived, and I died. Now, this is supposedly a Jewish Christian talking about his difficulty in dealing with the law. The very commandment which promised life proved death to me. See, the audience knows this is not Paul's talking. For sin, finding opportunity in the commandment, deceived me and it killed me. So the law is holy and the commandment is holy and just and good. Did that which is good then bring death to me? By no means. It was sin working death to me through what is good in order that sin might be shown to be sin, and though the commandment might become sinful beyond measure. As you can tell, this is not easy to understand. But this, again, this is not Paul talking. But as it goes on, you can see why people begin to think Paul might be, we're going to go on to verses 13 and 25, maybe Paul is a little crazy, but this is not Paul talking. We know now that this is still the imaginary character speaking. We know the law is spiritual, but I am carnal, soul under sin. I do not understand my own actions, for I do not do what I want, but I do the very thing I hate. Now if I do what I do not want, I agree the law is good. So then it is no longer that I that do it, but the sin that dwells within me. For I know that nothing good dwells within me, that is, in my flesh. I can will what is right, but I cannot do it. For I do not know the good I want, but the evil I do not want is what I do. Now if I do what I do not want, it is no longer I that do it, but the sin that dwells within me. So I find it to be a law that when I want to do right, evil lies close at hand. For I delight in the law of God in my inmost self, but I see in my members another law at war with the law of my mind and making me captive to the law of sin which dwells in my members. Wretched man that I am. So this, people read that and say, this guy has really got problems. But to a rhetorician who's studying this thing, this is not Paul talking. He's using this as an example. And Paul returned, this, it ends in verse 25 of Romans, and in the very next one, chapter 8, verse 1, Paul returns. And he says, therefore, now you can tell the whole tone has changed. Therefore, now there's no condemnation for those who are in Christ Jesus, for the law of the Spirit of life in Christ Jesus has set me free from the law of sin and death. For God has done what the law, weakened by the flesh, could not do, sending his own Son in the likeness of sinful flesh, and for sin. He condemned sin in the flesh in order that the just requirement of the law might be fulfilled in us who walk not according to the flesh, but according to the Spirit. And he goes on. You know, so he's now saying, all that stuff you just heard is wrong. All that stuff you heard from this other person is wrong. Because we have Jesus Christ. And so it's we don't have that problem anymore. And so this is a classic example of how if, reading in this way gives you some new insights into Paul. It doesn't necessarily change things in terms of what you believe about things, but it changes your view of Paul quite a bit because you realize that Paul, this is the rhetorical Paul that's always talking, not it's not Paul, the individual. So my overall summary of reading stuff this way is that the scholarly art of reading New Testament letters using rhetorical analysis, which is what I'm showing here, is now becoming better and better known. But it's still in its very early stages in terms of influencing any New Testament scholarship. There's still a lot of New Testament scholars who don't want to learn rhetoric, and they just don't want to look into this. Whether it really changes much in terms of influencing theology is still unclear, but actually I'm not sure it will a lot. But it may well change the way we review Paul. It's important as it develops and helping understand why writers like Paul wrote the way they did in their epistles. For myself, I do not intend to become a rhetorical I'm going to leave that to expert New Testament scholars and wait for them over time to publish more in the future and maybe help us to understand Paul better. There's just not that many of them, frankly, yet, that are willing to dive into this. But some very good ones are. I mentioned Luke Timothy Johnson. He is totally bought into this way of reading Paul. In fact, he teaches it in one of his books. So this is growing, but I don't think it's going to be very threatening to Christians, but it might help us understand a lot about Paul as we go along. Okay, questions about any of this? No, that's so far my understanding is not. And again, it's because not that many professors teaching the seminary know rhetoric yet well enough to feel comfortable with it. But it's probably growing. I mean, it's definitely in the academic world. Luke Timothy Johnson, who I talk about a lot, he teaches at a university, teaches New Testament studies. And so he's into this, and a lot of others are growing into it. But it's actually difficult, and they all say it's difficult. And one thing I want to emphasize here, if you do start studying rhetoric and try to read Paul, it doesn't make Paul easier to read. It makes him harder to read. That's why I say I'm not going to try. But it does give you a very different insight into Paul and to others. And by the way, I now have spotted, and I was actually led there by some of the things I read. The book of James has got a lot of this stuff in it. Some of the things that James said about faith versus works is not quite the way I thought it was before, because James uses these arguments, and some of the times it's someone else talking in James too. So it's very interesting to read on. So that's kind of my overall summary. Now, as far as where we're going from here, over the next 3 weeks, we're going to now move into actually studying some of Paul's letters We're going to talk first about the problems of early Christianity, and then in the next 2 weeks after that, we're going to go take a pretty deep dive into 1st and 2nd Corinthians to see what, after we know what these problems are, which all came out of Paul's letters, by the way. That's where we learn everything about the early Christian churches and Paul's letters. We'll take two of them, 1st and 2nd Corinthians, and try to go into a fairly deep dive to see how Paul handled the problems in that particular set of churches. Questions that I have with? Do you all understand rhetoric now?
That really helps.
We did.
Thank you.
All right.
Why do these people always end up in politics?
Which people?
The people that know the rhetoric.
Oh. Well,
I don't want to go any further than that.
No. Maybe they get to the top because they know rhetoric.
Yes.
Jim and I just had a conversation outside of class. I asked him if rhetoric is taught in law school.
Yes.
Well, no, it's not taught that much. When he was going through school, it was not.
I don't understand.
Any other questions? Well, then we'll see you next week.
Thank you.